Now, if you're still awake. Chapter 15. While I lay low and stitched my wounds, Graham and I were able to turn our attention to a wide selection of writing. Our new private detective film, which was great fun to work on, as its farce-like quality allowed us to indulge in humour at the wilder and sillier end of the spectrum. Another draft of The Rise and Rise of Michael Rimmer, a TV special for the actress and comedian Sheila Hancock, which Graham and I wrote with Eric Idle. We had, of course, worked together with him on The Frost Report, but that was our first and very harmonious collaboration with him, and an invitation, right out of the blue, to write some sketches for Peter Sellers. Peter was at this time the world's leading comedy actor. He'd achieved this status in his Wonder Years of 1963-64, when he created the role of Inspector Clouseau in The Pink Panther and played three different characters in one of the greatest comedies of all time, Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove. I'd worshipped him since the days of The Goon Show, when he did the majority of the voices, and I'd seen him grow into a superb character actor in very English movies like The Lady Killers, Two-Way Stretch, and The Mouse That Roared. During this time, he came up with three of the greatest comedy albums ever made, produced by George Martin, the best songs being Songs for Swinging Cellars. While his appearance as a trade unionist called Fred Kite in I'm All Right, Jack showed that he could also be a fine straight actor. It had to be admitted, though, that by the time Graham and I went to meet him in the spring of 1969, we'd heard that he was getting a reputation for being difficult. During the filming of Casino Royale in 1967, the director, Joe McGrath, told me, Peter had said to him that he did not want to do his close-up shots the same day that Orson Welles did his. He wanted to wait until he'd seen Orson's close-ups in rushes so that he could then work out how to top him when he shot his own. The Peter that Graham and I met, though, couldn't have been friendlier. We showed him some of our sketches, and to our delight, he laughed a lot. And when he laughed, he really bust a gut. He fell about and hooted. You could see him suddenly become animated by a joyous comic energy of the kind that possessed Graham and me when we discovered a great comic idea. It was never a single great line that set us off. It was always the first perception of a great comic potential, prior to it being worked through. It seemed to me that when Peter experienced this glee, he became for a moment a bigger person than his normal, sociable, lower-key self. His first job for us was to come up with some sketches for an American special. I can only remember one of the pieces where Peter played an enterprising Scottish cloth manufacturer who had discovered some hitherto neglected tartans to sell to Americans, one from such clans as the McRoosevelts, the McJP Morgans, and the McGoldbergs. He was pleased with the way that the sketches were received, and to our amazement, immediately promoted us. He invited us to write a new draft of a screenplay based on Terry Southern's book, The Magic Christian. Gray and I therefore now found ourselves writing three movies. Peter started by explaining that there'd been several drafts of the script up to that point, and he showed us the most recent, the 14th draft, which contained quite the most exquisite stage directions I'd ever read. In the very first scene, an ornate clock on the mantelpiece was dwelt on in extraordinary detail. It was only when we read further, in search of dialogue, character, and plot, that the ghastly truth emerged. The script was just terrible. Graham and I were astounded. We yearned to ask one question. How could the writer of this material ever have been hired? However, the screenplay's bottomless ineptitude was very liberating in that it left us with nothing to defer to. So we went back to the Southern novel and found it a talented, if lazy, mess, with a great premise. An immensely rich but principled man, Sir Guy Grand, plays large-scale practical jokes on people for the sole purpose of revealing to them and to others the baseness of their real motives. It may sound a bit prissy, but its mood wasn't more satirical than didactic. Gray and I had a wonderful time inventing new pranks, including a skywriting plane that left very rude words above the crowds at Ascot, forcing the authorities to send up another skywriter to bowdlerize the vulgarities, resulting in a sky filled with words like arsenal, the penis mightier than the sword, Scunthorpe, prickly, and misfit. We came up with other absurdly expensive ideas on the huge cruise liner which Sir Guy has hired to host and ridicule his most powerful victims. There's a very expensive restaurant where, if you want a steak, you are escorted to a huge below-decks paddock where you can choose your own cut from a large, heavily bandaged herd of steers. Every morning we would arrive at Peter's flat at 10 o'clock and give him the pages that we'd written the previous day. And he would say, more of this or less of that. It was all remarkably relaxed, the temperature in the room rising only if Britt Eklund walked through in a dressing gown. I think even Graham enjoyed this. After a time, we began to socialise with Peter on an occasional basis. He took us to Hare, where I felt too shy to go up on stage with him to dance with everyone. Typical. He sent us to the theatre to see There's a Girl in My Soup by Terence Frisby, to advise him whether he should do the film of it. Snotty young know-it-alls that we advised against it. Sorry, Terry. But he ignored us, thank God, and made a very successful adaptation with Goldie Hawn. And a lot of time we just sat around when he told us wonderfully funny stories of his music hall days and of his time with the Goons. Of course, we always knew that he was a great voice man, but we marvelled privately at his ability to do people effortlessly. He only needed to listen to someone for a few minutes to be able to impersonate them perfectly. Indeed, many of his most famous voices were inspired by entirely chance encounters. He told us, for example, that once at the end of a theatre show, he'd been accosted by a very boring fan, a scoutmaster in full gear, and was about to flee when he heard the man speak. He immediately invited him back to his dressing room, gave him a drink, and kept him talking. Peter had found the perfect voice for the wonderful Goon Show character, Bluebottle. When Stanley Kubrick asked him to play Claire Quilty in Lolita, he was wondering how he would speak the role until he bumped into an American with an unusual style of speech. Peter then chatted to him for 20 minutes, after which he had the guy off pat. But the best story came from George Martin. While he'd been producing the Songs for Swinging Cellars album, he's fallen in love with one of the tracks in which a heartless agent is talking on the phone while auditioning an elderly Shakespearean actor who's trying to remember, unsuccessfully, a monologue from Richard III. To hear the poor old fool bumbling in the background while the agent chats up a girlfriend was absolutely hilarious, if somewhat cruel. When he played the edited album to Peter, George asked, "The sketch about that bastard agent, I know his voice from somewhere. Whose is it?" Peter replied, "It's yours." Then, one day, we got a first-hand insight into this extraordinary ability. We arrived at Peter's flat to be greeted by his Heart of Gold chauffeur, Bert. "He's overslept, boys. I'll make you coffee. Won't be long." So we sat there reading through our pages, and soon Peter appeared in his dressing gown, apologising for keeping us, but doing so in a quite unfamiliar voice, which a few seconds later became a rather plummy upper-class accent, before lapsing into recognisable Cockney. When he sat down on the sofa opposite, he morphed into a rather odd Eastern European dialect for about 10 seconds before he finally reverted to speaking in his usual manner. Gray and I pretended not to notice, but when we compared notes later, we both realised that each morning Peter Sellers had to find his own voice. It is a truth universally acknowledged that the greatest impersonators often have strangely colourless personalities. Perhaps their very lack of a strong identity means they have little of themselves to get in the way when they try to assume someone else's personality. I'm a poor mimic because I can't drop my own characteristics much, so when I impersonate someone, it sounds like them trying to impersonate me. As it happens, I greatly admire first-class mimics' super-sensitive powers of observation, extraordinary accuracy with which they observe vocal production, inflections, rhythms of speech, facial expressions, and body language. all those tiny, unique traits which they can then reproduce so precisely. But I also can't help wondering whether they are unconsciously observing others in the hope that they can find something there that they can borrow and incorporate into their own personality structure to strengthen their sense of self. Perhaps it's an extreme form of the desire most people display earlier in their lives to find role models. Of course, once impersonators have developed this ability, they're rewarded by the delight that they produce in an audience, whether they are at a party with friends or earning a living on television. So they have no reason to stop, even though its original purpose has never really been accomplished. One thing is for sure. In Peter's case, his weak sense of his own identity did not lead to a very stable existence. Gray told me once that he'd been talking to Peter when Peter was summoned to an important phone call. A few minutes later, Graham glanced up as someone entered the room, and it took him some time to realize that this someone was, in fact, Peter. He'd been so altered as a result of this obviously very difficult phone conversation that Graham had not recognized him. That said, Peter's behavior towards us was invariably kind and generous. He was a delight to work for, and though I'm aware he had a darker side, I never glimpsed it. He and David Frost, our two main employers, worked at opposite ends of the producer spectrum. Peter discussed our work, criticized it, and offered suggestions every time we had new scenes to show him, which was most weekdays. We love this, as it's always a thrill to work with someone who's better than you are, an experience I repeated 20 years later with Charlie Crichton on Wanda. David, by contrast, would discuss the general theme of the film a couple of times, and then we'd see him again when we'd finished the first draft a few weeks later. But essentially, he left things to us, trusting our talent. This is a rare quality. Most film executives believe that because they've been given an office with a big desk, they must simultaneously have received by some mystical process an understanding of comedy which its practitioners often find it takes 20 years to acquire. So they interfere all the time, not because they have anything useful to say, as Peter did, but because they are very anxious. A few years ago at Disney, a producer who had never written, performed, or directed any comedy was telling me how to make my screenplay worse, and I remember thinking that their office was the only place on earth where such a person could manage to sustain such an illusion of expertise. So, Gray and I reveled in our good fortune in working with two great bosses on three screenplays, The Magic Christian, The Rise and Rise of Michael Rimmer, and Rent-A-Sleuth. We were to work on these for most of the next year with very few diversions. We had become, by choice, full-time writers, and we loved it. I think it was a very happy time for both of us. Now that Graham had come out, David Sherlock was properly integrated into his social life, and he was finding writing a lot more fun than endless medical studies. He'd always been very serious about becoming a doctor, and he did eventually qualify. But I suspect that this was the year when he realized that comedy was his real passion. As for me, I was more content and relaxed than I'd been at any time since I'd left New York. I was, after all, married to Connie, and although I remained extraordinarily naive about the psychology of women, we loved each other's company and enjoyed endless visits to restaurants, the cinema. There were lots of great films in those days for people over 25. And, best of all, the theatre. It was a golden age of British playwrights. When I was not struggling to understand Pinter, even with Connie's help, I was discovering Peter Nichols, Alan Bennett, Tom Stoppard, Alan Ayckbourn, and Michael Frayn, all of whom, for several decades to come, were to provide some of the greatest theatrical comedy ever written. And that was in addition to some Fado farces at the National, which transported me to a brand new level of bliss. It was now that I realized that farce, acted with real seriousness, was my first love. I was also much more at ease now that I was free of the nerves that I'd experienced whenever I had to stand in front of an audience. The rhythms of a writer's life were congenial to me. If I was anxious about anything at that time, it was an absurd, but at that time ineradicable worry that I ought to be soaking up information about everything on the planet so that I would be as well informed as Leonardo da Vinci or John Stuart Mill or Mr. Bartlett. I was always in a state of awe when I found myself among highly informed people. Consequently, even when I was enjoying writing with Graham, there was a part of me that wanted to finish as soon as possible so that I could resume reading about ancient Egypt or precious stones or the history of anaesthetics, even though I knew that I read slowly, a hangover from studying science and law, and had a distinctly average memory. The only thing you learn when you're doing comedy is how to do comedy, so I always experienced a sinking feeling late on Sunday afternoons as I reluctantly put my books aside and started focusing on the week ahead. I called it putting on my blinkers. In the USA, putting on my blinders. That's not to say I didn't greatly enjoy writing with Graham. It was always difficult for us to get down to work in the morning, and we developed many strategies to postpone doing so. But as somebody said to me recently, it's hard to start writing, but it's hard to stop. Once I'd become absorbed, the desire to get the damn thing right conflicted with my other desire to settle down to that book about the Syrian Orthodox Church. Perfectionism is a good trait professionally, if unhelpful to the quality of your private life. Graham and I no longer worried so much when we had an unproductive session. We were experienced enough to be confident that we would soon be compensated by a fertile one. Our average rate was about 4 minutes of screen time a day, which may not sound much, but if sustained, would theoretically have given us a movie script every 6 weeks. When we started Python, our average dropped a little as we had no overall story to guide us through each day, because every morning we had to come up with a fresh idea, not just continue on from yesterday. Even so, we could still produce at least 15 minutes of sketch material each week, which, with 15 from Mike and Terry Jones and 8 from Eric, plus Terry Gilliam's animations and opening and closing titles, meant that we could edit all the weaker stuff out and still have enough material for one show, and often a bit to spare for the next. The great joy was the laughing. There would be a moment when a really funny, wild, zany idea popped into our heads, and we would both erupt. David Sherlock tells how there would suddenly be shrieking and howling and the drumming of feet like a child having a tantrum. Only this was the sheer delight of the lunacy of the idea, and how the screaming and howling with laughter would go on for some time before we actually settled down to write it. I think Gray and I, more than the other Pythons, would suddenly be possessed by this bolt of gleeful energy, and in such huge quantities that we could fully discharge it, not through plain laughter, but through physical pyrotechnics. We would howl and hoot and drum. Some years later, when I was being briefed to write a video arts film on some aspect of selling, an expert salesman told me that closing a sale was, for him, the next best thing to an orgasm. Clearly, he'd never written comedy. Gray and I led very separate social lives. We always had done since Cambridge days. I can scarcely recall us having dinner together except as part of the Python group, usually when we were away from home filming. But when we wrote in those days, we nearly always went out for lunch together, and our conversation was typically male. It would not have occurred to us to talk about private matters. Occasionally, Gray would say things that seemed rather strange. For a time, he would get quite angry about the selfishness of Buddhism, where people sat around meditating when they could be helping other people. He often expressed a strong dislike of gays who were effeminate. Once he became insistent about the idea that touching someone's genitals was really no different from touching their arm. Sometimes he would talk interestingly about medical matters. I can remember his telling me about iatrogenic diseases, diseases caused by doctors. but mostly it was politics, TV, comedy, and such like. My abiding memory of those times is that when we were not chatting, but often when we were writing, he could drift off into a reverie, stroking his sideburns while peering at his watch. Sometimes I couldn't resist taking advantage of this tendency to daydream. Once, when we were strolling together through a Knightsbridge arcade and he was miles away, I stopped him, grasped him firmly by his shoulders, turned him 90 degrees to the right, and shoved him very firmly into a posh jewellery shop. At first he was so inattentive, he offered no resistance. Then, realising what was happening, he tried to decelerate, but instead he tripped as he passed through the doorway of the shop, picked up speed, and with arms outstretched to soften the blow, ran full tilt into the counter. The salesman, standing right behind, jumped backwards and fell over. Gray now behaved with impeccable politeness, explaining to the poor, cowering man why he had sprinted at him and pointing outside at a man who was laughing so much that passers-by had stopped to watch and figure out what that individual was laughing at. On another occasion, I booked a table at one of our favourite restaurants, the German Food Centre, in the 1948 show-style name of Mr. Hyena Explosion. It had taken some time to re-pronounce and spell the booking on the phone, since the German Food Centre took these matters seriously, but eventually the reservation was agreed. When we arrived there at 1 o'clock, I made sure Gray was alongside me as I approached the maitre d'. "Mr. Hyena Explosion," I announced blandly. The maitre d's face lit up. Something that had clearly been on his mind all morning was now satisfactorily resolved. Alice in ordno. Beaming, he replied, "Of course, this way, please." I strode after him and then turned back to see Gray simply standing there with his mouth open. It took a lot to get his attention at times. Gray was always mildly irritated by any display of decorum or good taste, as he felt it was a direct challenge to his deepest beliefs. When I mentioned once that Connie and I had guests coming to dinner that evening who were a bit formal and stuck up, he carefully cut out some very small pieces of paper, wrote an obscenity on each one, and then hid them round our flat in all the rooms that our guests were likely to visit. Connie found one of these just 10 minutes before they were due to arrive, and in a moment of pure panic that set off a frenzied paper chase as we raced round the apartment trying to find them all before the doorbell rang. We missed one, which he had placed on the basin in the visitor's loo. It simply read, "Anus." I've always wondered whether our guests speculated why we might have put it there. Our enjoyment of practical jokes and our slowly growing reputation as writers came together one day when we were phoned by a Hollywood director called Sidney Salko, who was visiting London and wanted to meet us. The day of our rendezvous, we checked him out and found he had a string of films to his credit, every one of which sounded distinctly B-movie. We therefore decided that the room in which we were to meet should be decorated in a manner that would honour the importance of the occasion. I have always had an extensive collection of soft toys. I buy them by pretending they are for children. So now we raided this, placing the animals all round the room, partly hidden, with each one looking at the chair Mr. Salko would be sitting in. A squirrel behind that lamp, a leopard up on the curtain rail, a raccoon under this chair, an ostrich behind the television, a warthog on the windowsill, two badgers peering from the filing cabinet, an asp on the anglepoise, a tiny lemur peeping out of a tissue box, a giraffe hiding at the top of the curtains, a crocodile outside the window sellotaped to the ledge, looking in at Mr. Sarko's chair 3 feet away. Two zebras watching from a waste paper basket, monkeys on the light shade, all concealed as best we could so that our Hollywood director would spot them only one at a time. Our hope was that a slow, gradual realization that he had an audience of fauna would rattle him more than one huge, simultaneous zoological revelation. But Mr. Sidney Sarko was not the rattleable type. He entered the room like a typhoon, pumping our hands, exclaiming with great enthusiasm, congratulating us on all things British, and generally establishing his credentials as a high-end extrovert. And within seconds he was perched in his chair, gesticulating wildly, as he launched into a description of the opening scene of the movie he was so excited about us writing. "There's this huge castle in the middle of a plain, and it's got a huge front gate."
"Jonathan Graham," variously.
Where is this, Sydney?" Doesn't matter. "And a huge army is besieging this castle, right?"
"Yes, who?
It's been besieging this castle for months, right?"
"Right, but Sydney, who?"
"And the front gate of the castle bursts open, and three hogs run out. What an image, wow!"
Hogs?
Yeah, how about that?"
"Oh, you mean big pigs?"
"Yeah, the hugest you ever see, three of them."
"Sydney, why?"
"And strapped to the first hog is Ernest Borgnine."
"Ernest Borgnine?"
"Oh, Ernie and I go way back. He's committed to the movie. He's huge."
"Why is he?"
"And strapped to the second leg is, guess."
"Sir Laurence Olivier?"
No, Charlton Heston. "And guess who's strapped to the third hog?"
"Sean Connery."
"Sophia Loren. She's huge."
But why?"
"And the hogs run out towards the army."
Sydney.
What?
"Why are they strapped to the pigs?"
"Because it's a siege.
And?"
"They're showing the army how much food they've got left."
"What?"
"They got so much, they don't even need the three hogs."
"Oh, okay, but why have Ernest Borgnine, Charlton Heston, and Sophia Loren been strapped to them?" By this time, our minds were reeling, but I promise you, this is a pretty damn accurate account of what happened when we met our first Hollywood director. And as for the animals, we'd both assumed he'd missed them, but as we shook hands when we parted...
"So anyway, boys, think about it, okay?"
Yes, we will, Sydney, thank you.
"Oh, and by the way, nice animals."
Maybe the joke was on us. I just wish I could remember why Sophia Loren was going to be fastened to a pig. One way and another, Gray and I wrote together almost full-time from the How to Irritate People recording in May 1968 to the taping of the first Monty Python show on the 30th of August 1969. The only interruptions were the handful of days I spent in front of the camera in tiny roles dignified by the courtesy title of cameo. The first of these was on one of my favourite TV shows, The Avengers, with the third Emma Peel, Linda Thorson, in which I played a man who registered the copyright of the unique makeup of every single circus clown by painting it onto a real hen's egg. This, believe me, is how it really used to be done. I was duly surrounded by multiple racks of these eggs, and of course the payoff was that I ended up knocking them all over. Since by now I fancied myself at physical comedy, I told the director I thought I could floor every egg in one take, which would have helped as this was the last shot of the day and everyone wanted to go home. It turned out, however, that I couldn't. So the whole crew had to spend the next 2 hours putting the eggs back on the racks and trying to hide the bits that were cracked. Under massive pressure, I had got it right second time. And then the wondrous Dennis Norton, one of the half-dozen people who I would choose to join me on a desert island, somehow managed to get me small parts in two films he had written. The first, The Bliss of Mrs. Blossom, had me playing a clerk in a post office, supporting Freddie Jones and the great comic and cartoonist Willie Rushton. It was a fairly unremarkable experience, though I remember being struck by the care with which the director arranged an amusing sticker on a notice board behind me. Perhaps it was there in case the audience got bored watching me act. The other Norton gift, though, was much more memorable because it gave me my first experience of filming with a big Hollywood star. George Sanders was a super suave English actor who, along with James Mason, had cornered the market in elegant British swine rolls. Our scene together required me to play the manager of a tea plantation in the Far East, having dinner with my employer during a native uprising. And the humour stemmed from our very different reactions as the plantation villa was attacked during dinner. Sanders sitting there quite unconcerned, drinking his soup, while bullets whizzed everywhere, hitting the candlesticks and the crockery. Me, frozen and terrified, vacillating between trying to mimic his calm and diving for cover, and instant dismissal from my job. In those days before CGI, the action was for real. Crockery and cutlery were sent flying around, propelled into the air by jets of compressed air, and I had to hold a wax drinking glass full of red wine steady as it was shot out of my hand by a stuntman with a .22 rifle resting on the back of the chair just out of shot. I was, however, allowed to hold the glass at its base. I was touched when at one moment George Sanders actually stopped them shooting my close-up as it was becoming too dangerous for me. I was also impressed a little later when he insisted that some water that was to be thrown on him when he was in a bath should be really cold to help make his reaction to it as genuine as possible. We all watched him surreptitiously throughout the day as he gave the crew a masterclass in languid elegance. Some years later, I learned that he had committed suicide because he was bored. I admire insouciance greatly. This, however, seemed to be taking it a bit too far. It was Peter Sellers who was responsible for my next cameo appearance. At the end of one of our script sessions, he mentioned that Thames Television had decided to make a radio star recording of a famous old goon show, Tales of Men's Shirts, as a TV special. And he then casually asked me whether I'd like to play the announcer, the part originally played by Wallace Greenslade, when they recorded the show the following week. My mind reeled, but I said, as languidly as I could, that I thought I could fit it in. I'd been watching Mr. Sanders very carefully. And then I made Peter laugh by saying that I needed to agree the fee, as I wasn't sure that I could afford to pay it. An old joke, but a very appropriate one. What was wonderful about performing the Wallace Greenslade role was that there was no pressure on me to get more than the odd smile. And what was even more wonderful was that as the programme was being shot as a radio show, we all therefore had scripts in front of us, so there was no possibility of my forgetting any lines. So I was able to stand next to the trio that I had worshipped since the age of 14. Occasionally reading a paragraph when the red light blinked and feeling both thrilled and slightly numb. I didn't screw up, it all went very smoothly, and suddenly it was over and there I was, back home on the sofa, trying to decide whether it had really happened. And I checked the next day and it had. Meanwhile, Gray and I were steaming ahead with our three film scripts. Our second draft of The Magic Christian, that was the film's 16th draft so far, was deemed good enough to secure financing for the enterprise. But to our disappointment, Terry Southern was then invited to do the final draft and proceeded lovingly to reinstate the mess that we'd been first presented with. We both hated the end result. Well, you'd expect that if you knew writers as well as I do. Graham wondered whether a Mr. Jack Daniels should have been credited as Southern's co-writer. Even so, it was hard to resist when Peter Sellers offered me a small part opposite him in a rather good scene where Sir Guy Grand purchases a School of Rembrandt portrait and then cuts out the nose of it with a knife, explaining to my character, a snotty young art dealer, that he only collects noses. I, of course, have to react with horror, and I exclaim, shit! This was quite a naughty word in 1968. So naughty, in fact, that when some months later my scene was shown on television to promote the movie, I became, as far as I know, the first person ever to say shit on British television. This, incidentally, is one of my three claims to fame. The others are that I have a species of lemur named after me, and that I was once French-kissed on camera by Tim Curry. While the Magic Christian was trundling along, David Frost managed to secure financial backing for the Rimmer film. We all agreed that Peter Cook would be great as the brilliant pollster who manipulates the results so that he ends up as Prime Minister. And I was delighted when I'd heard that Kevin Billington was to be the director. I'd been hugely impressed by his clarity and bright, enthusiastic energy when I'd worked with him on Interlude. Since he and Peter were so much better informed about the British political scene than Graham and I, it seemed the perfect plan for the four of us now to work together on the script until we started shooting at the end of June. And since Graham and I knew nothing about the actual process of putting a film together, it was a relief to have someone like Kevin to explain how it all unfolded and what had to be decided when and by whom. For his part, I think that Kevin found Gray slightly disconcerting. During our first week working together, the four of us were walking up to a Polish restaurant we frequented in Hampstead when Kevin dropped his voice and asked me, "Does Graham always say as little as this when he's writing?" The funny thing is, I was surprised. I'd got so used to Gray that his behaviour no longer struck me as odd. Our meetings were held at Peter's house in Church Row in Hampstead, and the collaboration became a very happy one. A few weeks before, I had appeared, both as Robin Hood and as a butler, in a TV show that Peter and Dudley were putting together. But as it hadn't involved individual scenes with either of them, I hadn't got to know Peter particularly well. Now, though, I saw him regularly, and while at first I felt like a new boy in his presence, I soon relaxed. He was so welcoming, cheery, and easy to write with. And he was effortlessly, brilliantly funny all the fucking time. We'd be sitting there discussing some aspect of the plot, and he'd slide into a five-minute monologue that he could just as easily have bestowed on a West End audience. As Frank Muir once said, he could saw it off by the yard. His excellent biographer, Harry Thompson, relates that after Peter had been staggeringly funny one evening, he quietly lamented to a friend that none of it had been written down. It was lost forever. Later, though, I began to see there was a downside to Peter's superb talent. It flowed so easily for him that he never had to learn to grind it out like the rest of us. Consequently, when inspiration did eventually begin to fail him, he lacked a writer's cussed determination to keep at it until things begin to flow again. Not that this was remotely a problem. When we were working on Rimmer, our sessions were always productive and enormous fun. So by the spring of 1969, everyone was happy with the script. Kevin was able to start casting, shooting began at the end of June, and I had a small part as a man called Ferret, who is learning the tango. With Rimmer well on its way, Graham and I were now able to switch our focus to the Rent-a-Sleuth screenplay. Whereas Rimmer was a satire, albeit a not very sophisticated one, this was out-and-out comedy, and we thought some of it was really funny. There was a great scene where the Ronnie Corbett character has trapped a bullion van and is trying to force the Ronnie Barker character to unlock the doors by filling up the driver's cab with water from a hose. In another scene, Marty Feldman steals an invalid carriage, which turns out not to be very fast, and Timbrook Taylor hijacks an ice cream van, similarly handicapped, to pursue him, so that during their furious race, they are passed on either side by cars, bicycles, and eventually joggers. And finally, in an extended sequence, Gray and I feed doctored meat to a couple of Doberman Pinscher guard dogs to render them unconscious. The meat fails to have any effect, so we have to ply them with more and more until after a time they become so friendly that they let us in anyway, following us everywhere, wagging their tails and demanding more meat while we burgle the place. Of course, when the supply of meat runs out, the dogs turn nasty. This was the kind of material Gray and I love writing best. One foot in a crime drama where the consequences were theoretically serious, the other foot in extreme silliness, but with all the behaviour kept just believable. In other words, more farcical than the usual heist movie. And the most exciting thing was that we lined up a cast that could do what the very best comedians can manage. They can go over the top while taking the audience with them. That is, they can make people accept absurdity where many good comedy actors would fail. With David Frost's approval, we started looking for a director, and this led me to possibly the most embarrassing moment of my life. First, we approached Dennis Norden, for us the expert on comedy in the UK, but Dennis simply had no desire to direct. I completely sympathised with him. Next, my agent asked me if I knew a director called Jay Lewis. Now, as it happened, I did. I'd met him on holiday, and I liked him immensely. My agent read me his credits, not great, but very good, and told me that Jay had looked at the script and really liked it. Would I ring him? Well, I was just about to go abroad for a few days, but I promised that I would call the moment I got back, which I duly did. The phone was answered by Jay's girlfriend, the actress Thelma Ruby. I greeted her, told her I was delighted to hear the news about Jay. "We buried him this afternoon," she replied. I stammered that I was not delighted that he was dead, just that I was delighted that he'd liked the script before he died, and that and I said, "I'm sorry," and put the phone down and killed myself several times. Now we were asked if we knew a Charles Crichton. We looked him up and leapt about excitedly when we discovered that he directed for the Ealing Studios, which between 1949 and 55 had made the greatest batch of comedy films England ever produced. Charlie had made my second favourite after The Lady Killers, called The Lavender Hill Mob. So we sent our script off to him and then recalled that our ending, the one we'd just written, was a complete and deliberate steal from that very film. Or, let us say, it had influenced us greatly. Fortunately, we discovered when we went to meet him that he'd not noticed. Even better, we realised after about 5 minutes that we had stumbled across a treasure. A man who knew so much more about film than anyone that we'd ever met that it was almost embarrassing. We'd pack up for the day, having left some problem unresolved, and then the next morning, Charlie would push a sheet of paper towards us, rather shyly while puffing on his pipe, and we would glance at it and realise that he'd not only come up with the solution, but somehow it also clarified a plot point and added a good joke. Under his tutelage, the script improved rapidly to the point when in August, just before Rimmer stopped shooting, Variety carried a story that David Frost's film company's second film, Rent-A-Sleuth, would be helmed by Charles Crichton and written by Graham Mee. Sadly, it never happened. David Frost quietly sold our script to a producer called Ned Sherrin, who immediately refused to use Charlie without giving any reason why. We admired Charlie so much that we just walked away from the project, followed by the rest of the cast. Sherrin then changed the film's title to Rent-A-Dick, he had a great fondness for smut, and proceeded to produce a stinker. Such a stinker, in fact, that the film critic Alexander Walker memorably described it as another nail in the coffin of the British film industry. Sherrin had had it rewritten entirely, of course. One way and another, it was just as well that Gray and I parted company with our script, as we swiftly came to the conclusion that Sherrin was tasteless, slimy, and incompetent. Shortly afterwards, he tried to cheat us financially, so we added treacherous to the list. He had a habit of turning up for meetings with us, accompanied by a different young waiter each time, who would sit patiently some distance away while we discussed the film. We shuddered to think for what purpose he was waiting. Money, we assumed. The one thing I'm grateful for is that Sherrin was still alive and kicking when Charlie won his Oscar nomination for Best Director for Wonder. Incidentally, last week, Graham conveyed by Ouija board his endorsement of this particular paragraph. Perhaps this is the moment to admit that although Gray and I had two films being shot and a third confirmed, and although it's pretty rare for young screenwriters to have 3 out of 3 scripts actually made, the reality was that we didn't have much idea what we were doing. We could write good jokes and funny scenes, but we didn't know how to structure a full-length film. It's not that hard to get the hang of writing sketches, and by now Gray and I were capable of writing a very decent TV half hour. In fact, during this period, the best sitcom we did was a pilot for Humphrey Barclay, based on Richard Gordon's Doctor in the House. With Gray's medical student background, it proved surprisingly easy to create a funny and believable program, and it gave rise to a long-running series. But a feature of 100 minutes is a different kettle of fish, a bird of another feather, a different ball game, and a horse of a dissimilar hue. If a half-hour sitcom is, say, 7 times harder to write than a sketch, then a movie is 20 times harder than a sitcom, especially if it is a comedy. And if you think this is special pleading by a comic, just write down the names of 50 great dramas and then struggle to come up with 15 great comedies. Of course, film scripts are hard to get right in any case. My friend William Goldman, whom I regard as one of the greatest of all screenwriters and author of the best book about Hollywood, Adventures in the Screen Trade, once told me he found them much more difficult than novels or plays. The need to keep the plot moving all the time is a hugely demanding one. The slightest moment of stagnation and a cinema audience is immediately bored, though a lot of explosions do help to sustain their attention. Add to that the following difficulty in comedy. You cannot make an audience laugh continuously for 100 minutes. Human psychology and physiology will not allow it. So you have to plan a sequence of alternating peaks and troughs in the laughter while ensuring that you engage the audience's attention fully during the passages that are not trying to be funny. In 40 Towers, Connie and I were able to build the tension and the laughs continuously, but if you try to do this for more than about 35 minutes, some kind of ennui infects the audience. I don't know why exactly, but it does. Sir Henry Irving was asked on his deathbed whether dying was hard. No, he replied, dying is easy. Comedy is hard. You will now understand why I've managed to write only one really good film script in 50 years, apart from helping with the Python ones. While Graham and I were happily writing our 3 films, we knew to some extent that we didn't know what we were doing. We just didn't really grasp the depth of our ignorance. Fortunately, the people around us were generally as clueless as we were, which is why the films got financed. But they all failed by quite a comfortable margin. Rentadick, producer Ned Sherrin, being by far the direst. So it was probably a good thing that Gray and I at this point got involved in something we were good at. And it was all because every Thursday afternoon we take into the habit of stopping work early in order to watch a children's program. It was called Do Not Adjust Your Set, and it featured Michael Palin, Terry Jones, Eric Idle, and latterly some of Terry Gilliam's earliest animations. And it just happened to be the funniest thing on English television morning, noon, or night. Of course, we knew the first 3 well, so after one particularly brilliant show, I said to Gray, why don't I give them a call and see if they want to do a show with us? Graham agreed. I rang Michael. We all met a few days later and came to the conclusion that it felt like a good idea. And we then approached Barry Took, Marty Feldman's old writing partner, whom we knew quite well from the Frost Report, and who was some kind of consultant with the BBC. Barry, in turn, arranged for us to see Michael Mills, the head of BBC Comedy. On the appointed day, we trooped into Michael's office. He greeted us and said that he'd heard that we wanted to do a comedy series. We said, well, that's right. And he said, well, tell me what you got in mind. And, of course, we couldn't. I know it seems incredible, but we had had no proper discussion of what kind of show we were going to do. We just wanted to do one. Michael Mills was obviously expecting some kind of presentation, so as the silence grew ever more embarrassing, he began prompting us. Will you have guest stars? We looked at each other. Probably not. Music? Some. Not a lot. Film? Oh, yes, definitely some film, yes. The six of us just sat there looking clueless and unprofessional in front of the most important man in British television comedy. It was humiliating. And I was about to suggest we should go away and discuss what sort of show we did intend to do and then come back in a couple of months or years, when Michael Mills suddenly shrugged and said in a resigned tone, "Oh, go away and make 13 programs." He didn't even ask for a pilot. As we thanked Michael and left his office happy and excited, we had no idea just how lucky we had been. For the world of television would soon start to change and make a decision of the kind Michael had just made inconceivable. But being nascent pythons, we still delayed figuring out what it was that we were going to do. We were given a production schedule, and Gilliam convinced various BBC financial folk that he really could produce animation at the tiny cost he claimed was possible. But otherwise, there was no progress at all, because we were all heavily involved in other projects, and even when we did manage to meet, all our efforts went into coming up with a title for the show, which the BBC was now obsessively demanding. Every time we thought we had come up with one, we would then panic the next morning and phone each other and cancel it. So we worked our way through A Horse, a Spoon and a Basin, Owl Stretching Time, Bun Whacket, Buzzard, Stubble and Boot, The Toad Elevating Moment, and You Can't Call a Show Betty. Eventually, the BBC gave up on us and started referring to the show as Barry Took's Flying Circus. We liked the flying circus bit and nearly attributed its ownership to Gwen Dibley, Michael Palin's suggestion. She had on one occasion taught him some music. Finally, one evening, somebody suggested Python, a great name for an untrustworthy impresario, I thought, and someone else added Monty, which had connotations of our greatest Second World War general. There was hysteria, inexplicable, and history was made. A few nights later, I happened to watch a new Spike Milligan comedy show called Q5. I was dismayed. It was brilliant. I rang Terry Jones. "Yes," he said, "I've just seen it too." "But," I said, "I thought that's what we were going to do." "So did I," he replied. Still, we now had to create Python. And we debated for some time about what kind of style the show should adopt. Michael and Terry Jones, inspired by Terry Gilliam's animation, suggested a stream-of-consciousness approach. For our part, Graham and I felt we just needed to get rid of a lot of the conventions of TV comedy without being absolutely sure of what they all were. When we actually met to plan the first program, however, we floundered around playing with a few ideas that nobody was excited by. And then we realized that nothing was going to happen until we all went home and started to write. So the next morning, Gray and I sat down and stared into the distance for a bit before, as usual, I picked up Roger's thesaurus and started reading words out at random. Buttercup. Filter. Catastrophe. Glee. Plummet. "Ah," said Gray. "I like plummet." A couple of minutes passed. "A sheep would plummet, wouldn't it?" one of us said. "If it tried to fly, you mean," said the other. I should explain that when you've written a piece for someone, you can never remember afterwards who actually contributed what. "But why would it want to fly? To escape?" A couple of months later, the flying sheep became the first Monty Python skit to be recorded. I still vividly recall the moment about 2 minutes before taping started when I stood in the wings with Michael Palin watching as the moment approached for Terry Jones to walk up to Graham to begin the dialogue. "Michael," I said, "do you realize we could be the first people in history to record a comedy show to complete silence?" There was a pause, and Michael responded, "I was having the same thought." We had no idea at all whether people would think Python was funny. It really felt that risky. But the sketch started. Michael and I strained our ears. A giggle. A small laugh. Another giggle. A big laugh. And we looked at each other, and I thought, maybe it's going to be all right.